Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and this is the last episode of the summer feature of The Sound of Economics, recorded as part of the Reopening Europe project. Between the 12th and the 27th of June, we traveled more than 2,700 kilometers through the Netherlands, Germany, France, Austria, Slovenia, and Italy to collect voices from the ground during the weeks when the borders were reopening after the COVID-19 spring lockdown.
And at one moment they closed off the borders.
Even the one with the salary, they lost the job.
Had to close the restaurant, so it was a little bit stressful.
Nous avons pu travailler avec les partenaires des différents pays.
Afgelopen woensdag kreeg ik een berichtje van de wethouder.
Finalmente hanno riaperto i confini.
Since the beginning of the summer, the pandemic has continued to ravage the globe, and in Europe we are currently seeing a recrudescence of the infections. The next few months continues to be uncertain on the medical side, as well on the economic consequences of the pandemic. So given this context, the Reopening Europe project is assuming an additional layer of documenting the seemingly ephemeral moment of the summer reopenings, but also a reflection from the ground about the hopes and the wishes of European citizens in that specific and unique moment. That is why, in this concluding episode of this feature, we want to reflect about the future, not as an escapist wishful thinking, but as an attempt to start reimagining a society, an economy, and politics cohabiting with the virus and eventually overcoming it. For this reflection, I'm happy to host today Bruegel senior scholar Alicia Garcia Herrero, who is a regular here at Sound of Economics. Hi Alicia, how are you?
Very well, Giuseppe.
You're joining us from Taipei, right?
That's right.
What time is it over there?
Well, it's 10 o'clock in evening, and 10 for Taiwanese, hardworking Taiwanese means straight either in bed or, you know, very much about to be in there very soon. So that's life here. It's very different from Southern Europeans, as you know.
So thank you, Alicia, for joining and being up so late for this recording session. And we have also the pleasure to have Rutger Sjörgrim, if I pronounce you correctly, with us. Joining virtually. Hi, Rutger. You are in Stockholm, right?
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And how do you pronounce your family name? Sorry.
It's pronounced Sjögrim.
Ah, okay. I would never I would never manage. Rutger is an architect, part of the studio Secretary, and his work focuses on early stage concept development in relation to architectural competition, urban development projects, commercial events, film media, and the production of architectural imagery and visualizations. And Rutger is also a lecturer at the School of Architecture at KTH in Stockholm. It's a little bit of an unusual kind of guest for The Sound of Economics, and we will speak more about your work later, Rutger, especially the link with science fiction. But first things first, during the Reopening Europe road trip, we have asked citizens how do they see the future? Not how they would predict it, but how they would wish it or imagine it.
At least on some issues, we're all hoping for things to partially change. And on other issues, we are really hoping that that things stay the same.
I know I'm asking to have the same situation as before.
If you look at the Earth, you see, okay, we are using 1.7 Earths out there. We need less products, and we need products that use only very small resources.
But in 20 years, I think maybe it's not like this vision. I just think it can be very beneficial to think more about the materials you use in art.
The culture can give a perspective on what could be the future. They can dream, because when you are fear and scared, you cannot have this open mindset for what can be our future.
I would like to have like a day, Feiertag. Like a day when everything is closed and nobody's allowed to go out to remember the time when COVID was and to remember back which thing in life are really important and which are not. Because I think that people now are forgetting like the things they learned in COVID time.
So this was just a small flavor of the palette of opinions we collected on the road. And so one of the questions we asked to the people was, how do you imagine, wish, the future of work, of Europe, of your city in 20 years' time? And I would like to ask the same question to you, not how you would predict, but how you would wish it to be somehow linked to the specific moment that we are living and the COVID-19 pandemic.
I think 20 years is an interesting time span to think of in terms of future, because it's very much within the policy and planning horizon of the present. So it's very much something that we anticipate today, for example, in architectural design or when we plan our cities and also construct policies. The 20 to 30 to 40 year kind of perspective, it's very much something that we concerns the present. And I think also looking 20 years into the future, basically any important keystone technology of that future exists today. So we can think of something that is it's kind of quite similar, I think, to the present in a sense. But then I thought it's interesting to think about sort of generations. In 20 years, I will be 60 years old. So I will then be at sort of the peak of whatever influence and power I can hope to obtain. The boomer generation will be dying. Generation X will be entering kind of retirement, and you know, Greta Thunberg will be in her mid-40s. So I think from that perspective, maybe sort of that generational shift also provides some kind of hope, or hope for positive change, I think. And I think if I were to hope for something, I think it would be maybe a new kind of modernity or a new kind of modern project. Kind of reinvigorated belief that together we can build a world that is better for everybody, you know. But from perhaps a more pluralistic position than the last time we tried.
Some sort of neo-modernist movement.
Yeah.
Interesting. Alicia, what about you?
Well, I'm afraid that I will be older than Rutger in 20 years' time. And I won't be at the peak, but I will be somewhere else, like literally in decline. So, you know, I mean, from my perspective, what do I want to see as a citizen who will be literally 70 plus then? I hope that by then, 70 plus really means you still can have, you know, a very, very dynamic life, and that you can still reshape the world as much as young people can. Because, and I want to stress this idea, because I think we are losing the wisdom, you know. I've lived in Asia for a long time, so I do feel that respect for the experiences that we have lived. Think about COVID-19. I mean, somebody who's been in key positions in basically taking tough decisions during this period. What can this person provide for a world in 20 years? A lot. So I would like to see that dynamism of the elderly, sorry to say, but I see that here. And I think it's very valuable, because you can be an aging society but continue to be dynamic in ideas, as far as I can as you can put together the ideas from everybody, from every generation, you know, just different perspectives. So I think we need to do that as Europeans, simply because of our demographics. It's very important for us. And if we want to keep you know that rhythm of what it was, what is going to be, you need to bring that wisdom. So that's first thing. The second thing I'd like to see is maybe, I mean, I'm everything but a physicist. I have no idea, but I shouldn't use this expression since I probably don't understand it, but I will use it. It's kind of thermodynamics. What I mean to say is that I would like to see a world in which I want to live where you can choose your speed at no cost, or at very little cost. Now it has a humongous cost. You know, we are in a world of efficiency. We are in a world of production. We're in a world of consumption. All of that means that the faster, the better. Yeah, it's kind of because of the world we have built. And I think I'm not arguing that dynamism or speed or efficiency is not good. It might be good for certain things, but it might not be good for others. And I think we need to allow for that diversity in speed, in depending on where you are. So again, going back to the elderly, respect their speed. And as a first note of respect, and respect that some people may prefer lower growth. I mean, I'm an economist, so, you know, I respect that. Respect, accept, and even understand that it might be better. I mean, of course, this is climate change, but not only. It could also be, less consumerism, simply because we just want to go slowly and we don't need so many things. So I some may continue to do so if they so wish, because, you know, I would not argue in favor of everybody slowing down. And the reason is, and I'm going to now bar the idea of course, climate change because of all of the synergies or, you know, like, how would I say, interrelation. So it's not easy for somebody to go quickly, say China or by Vietnam and others, to go slowly and have no consequences. I understand that, but I'm going to put that aside. My point is that we can't really expect everybody to go at our speed. So, but find new models in which you accept the consequences and even like the consequences of different speed is something we should not be ashamed of as Europeans. We should actually sell, I mean, market around. If we were able to convince the world that actually slow is good, it's like slow food, slow, you know, I think it's something that we Europeans could export as ideas. Not everybody will follow, and it's fine with me. But it is nothing to be ashamed of, and I think it's very important. And COVID-19 has shown us that it's actually a plus, that you can reflect, that you can change habits. If you take the time, frankly, we were obliged to take the time for a change, but we learned that we can change. And I think that's very powerful. And I hope we can, you know, put that forward in 20 years and learn that every speed is fine if we know why we choose that speed, what's the reason behind. Not because we're lazy, slow, or elderly, like, you know, like aging like Europeans, but because we might actually be comfortable with that. So these are the two things I wanted to mention. Yeah.
I mean, that's extremely interesting because to me, what you say, Alicia, and what Rutger said about a new sort of modernist project that at the same time takes into consideration the multiplicity rather than, you know, one way to look at the future, the growth, the speed in this case, they look very complementary to me. And so it's very interesting that on this we can get something. It looks almost as the beginning of the construction of something that could be a coherent, modern modeling for the future. On this, I would like to ask Rutger, because you are the architect who built the spaceship that featured in the Swedish science fiction movie Aniara. And the movie is inspired by a poem written in 1956 by the Swedish Literature Nobel Prize, Harry Martinson. Now, this is quite interesting to me, because Aniara is also the reason why I contacted you for this conversation in the first place. Not just because I'm a science fiction geek, but especially because both the poem and the movie can be, I mean, to me, can be an important inspiration and reflection in this moment of global pandemics. And you set somehow already a little bit the scene about the kind of reflection that that we are making over there. Could you tell us a little bit more about Aniara in general? Because there is quite a lot of listeners that might not be based in Sweden that listen to our podcast, and they might not be familiar with Aniara, and tell us a little bit about your experience in working with the concept and the spaceship.
Absolutely. First of all, my role on this project was as a concept designer, and that's something I did together with three other people. So like, this was a kind of a shared pleasure and effort together with Andreas Nordström, Fredrik Andersson, and Kristina Sundin. Everybody mentioned, and also like in close collaboration with the directors and writers of the movie, Pella Kågeman and Hugo Lilja. Aniara is, I mean, as you said, it's a poem by the Swedish Nobel laureate Harry Martinson, and it's written in the 50s. The first parts of the poem, that consists of a total of 103 verses, was written quite shortly after the Soviet Union detonated their first hydrogen bomb, in this kind of feverish haze of the author, and it's a dark tale. It's about this spaceship going back and forth between the Earth and Mars, evacuating the people of Earth, since we by then have properly destroyed our planet, nuclear holocaust, environmental disasters, etc. The ship gets thrown off course, and they cannot turn back. And then, I mean, people live there for maybe 25, 30 years, they die, and then eventually the ship crashes into the nearest star some 5,000 years later. So it's this story about, I don't know, like it's kind of, I think if I'm to sum up, you know, the critique of the movie or like the poem, it's very much about this. Not only did humanity destroy, you know, the world that gave birth to us, but we also failed to see the emancipatory potential in this new world, you know, like the spaceship. They have power, they have air, they have the ability to produce food. So, I mean, technically they could produce a new utopia there, drifting indefinitely through the stars, but they don't. They fall into despair, they lose hope, there's no point in anything. You have strange cults. And eventually, it's just people just give up. So the poem is, in a sense, a very kind of idiosyncratic meditation on, you know, the violence of humanity, and in the end, our insignificance.
But one thing that struck me, and that's why I wanted to bring it also now at the end of the cycle of reopening Europe, is that actually during the lockdown, I had a lot of scenes that reminded me being on that kind of spaceship, or like Aniara kind of style thing, because you've been seeing things proliferating, like people at some point were all doing their all gardening, or like all doing like yoga sessions, or like, you know, you could really see, sometimes you could feel kind of in this claustrophobic space of your own apartment. And I think this collective experience that we had in lockdown is pretty much similar, or like to what is described in the poem. And what I find interesting in the movie, and that's something that maybe you can say a couple of words about, is this link, because you, I mean, of course, the poem was written in the 50s, but the movie was done a couple of years ago. In the movie, there is some sort of, you know, critique to the actual, you know, society we live in, and the actual spaceship that you built, the space that you built was reflecting this some sort of almost satire to the current state of affairs and of the world.
Yeah, I mean, like it's conceptualized as this like infinite interior of just contemporary capitalist consumption, basically. One of the models that we've used to sort of in order to think about the ship is this cruise ship that goes back and forth between Stockholm and Helsinki. In Stockholm, we call them the Finland ferries, and the Finns call them the Stockholm ferries. It's basically like a 24 or 48-hour party boat, which kind of you load 3,000 people on it, and then they go to Helsinki and back, and you like they're dispersed sort of on them the dock, and it's an interesting kind of environment because it's this fabulous or fantastic somehow or like night of partying. But it's repeated over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, like every day. So it's also interesting to imagine, you know, like it as the reality of people working there. And then thinking of this spaceship environment, it's a evacuation, but it's kind of conceptualized as this cruise. So it's a three-week cruise from Earth to Mars, and then it's supposed to end. But then people get trapped. And so what's supposed to be, you know, exciting or interesting, you know, travel through space, just becomes this strange everyday
situation. So, yeah. What I found in this story was interesting for us in this moment also is that it is somehow hard to elevate ourselves while we are living the emergency of the pandemics, and especially analyzing the economic impact. That is something that at Bruegel we've been doing quite in depth in these months, and we are continuing to do it, was that sometimes it is hard to elevate ourselves on a more long-term discussion about what we could potentially learn from the situation we are in. And so it seems to me that what you're saying and what science fiction could give us at least some methodological tools for long-term thinking and modeling. And Alicia, you certainly don't write science fiction, but as you have seen in the past month, our reality becomes strangely close to science fiction. So beside asking you what are your first thoughts on what Rutger has just told us, I would like to ask what could we say in terms of the methodological needs that we have now during this pandemic to continue thinking about the long term when everything is so uncertain and short term. Are we even potentially seeing having the case for a rethinking of economy? Of economics as a discipline in this case, on a larger scale, as a consequence of what we are living now?
I think there are two important issues in your question. One is, can economies focus on relevant stuff, sorry to say? I mean, in the sense that we're all looking at, okay, can we figure whether we know where the economy will be tomorrow using, I don't know, electricity data, neocasting, you name it. But does it make a difference tomorrow? You know what I mean? Like, can the recovery be V-shaped, W-shaped? I mean, compared to how the world structurally will be, it's just a very minor question. It might be relevant for stock market performance, etc., but it's actually not very relevant for human beings. And we end up there first because it's easier with our tools. So it's just, you know, human beings, we feel more comfortable. But it doesn't really respond to me to what an economist really needs to do as a profession. You know, so the key questions that we should be aiming at are really about what kind of economic model will be run as a consequence of a shock such as COVID-19, rather than trying to measure the shock every day, because it doesn't make a difference. You know, if as long as I know, and everybody knows this by now, that this is a bigger shock than anything we've seen in the last 100 years, I don't need to know how much worse. It doesn't matter. But that's how we, you know, well, of course, I'm exaggerating. It does matter if you're a policymaker and you want to reduce the pain and, you know, what amount of medicine you want to give. But so I'm not saying it's useless, but it's only part of the story. The most important thing, though, is to understand whether our economic model, i.e., let's call it social capitalism, because that's what I think Europe is, can be maintained. So before COVID-19, the answer, or at least not the answer, but the consensus, or at least my reading of the consensus, was that maybe not, because it is either capitalism, so US way, which looked relatively, successful in as far as it was creating innovation and new companies and, you know, dynamic, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, the Chinese model basically planned and so socialism or with Chinese characteristics, but not this mixture. I mean, the European kind of halfway, yeah, have it all but have nothing. Now, frankly speaking, with COVID-19, and I'm telling you from the Asian perspective, I had a big meeting yesterday with the largest think tank here, government think tank, and it's very interesting. They were telling me, we never thought the European model could actually be a model. And I was like, wow. But why did they say that? Basically, because the whole point was, and of course they were not talking about our ability to track cases or, you know, no, it was about the acceptance of giving to save the boat, if you see what I mean. Like basically sharing the cost, even across borders, you know, to save the boat. For them, that was, it's kind of, wow, Europe can do this. And most importantly, the idea that, you know, values or that our model, I mean, welfare, etc., is to be preserved, you know, that conviction in a way. So if you do lots of surveys, I mean, I know about my own country, I don't know about Europe as a whole, we still show that people are happy. Probably I've even seen that for the Nordic countries, to pay taxes as long as they keep this model. I mean, for them, this is amazing. So I think we have to basically rethink the criticism we had about our model, or the general criticism, and also see what's the positive. And even again, maybe portray it to others, because the key problem with our model, in my opinion, was that nobody else was following it. So it was becoming unsustainable because it was too expensive compared to, you know, the Asian way to produce, you know, with much lower, obviously, not only labor costs, but also security, yeah, for labor, protection, etc. So maybe now, after COVID-19 and kind of all feeling the pain of losing lives and how important it is to have a good health care system for everybody and blah, 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 maybe we can be more proud first, and second, more prominent in exporting our model. Because this is something that we need to realize, that if others do not follow, it's still going to be very costly, because you still can't, you know, kind of can't fight against the, it's like, yeah, again, it's like Don Quixote, yeah, with the windmill is there, and the point is you can't do anything because it's bigger than you. So but if others follow in your behavior, I mean, I don't mean to say that when go back to colonialism and impose our ideas. But frankly, we went too far in thinking that everything we were doing was bad. And I think COVID-19 may be showing a little bit of a positive on this.
Alicia, thank you. Rutger, I'm looking at you because maybe economics can borrow some methods and practice from architecture in a conversation about the future or in this kind of reflection in response to what Alicia has just been telling us.
I think we can inspire back and forth in a sense. I mean, for architects, economics are hugely important since it determines, you know, like the why things get built in the first place and like why certain things get built over other. But I mean, architecture is basically the profession of trying to conceptualize the future and then drawing it into reality. And that profession pushed into science fiction then, in a sense, which is kind of the spectrum that I sometimes engage in. And then I work with more projects that occupy themselves with the, you know, like the now and the everyday. I think it's important to generate images to visualize that future. One thing that we've been talking about as a kind of continuing project here at our office is this search for like an aesthetic of the welfare state, or this idea that in order for things to exist, in order for us to care about things, we need to know how they look, how they feel somehow. That we've talked about it previously in relationship to projects that we've done. That, I mean, if we look at Sweden, there are like millions of square meters of interior space that is kept, that is cared for, that we own collectively, as, you know, from parliamentary lobbies to mines, basically. And this is all part of our shared property. Things that, like, for example, our taxes goes into maintaining, things that fund our school system. And if we don't know that they exist, if we can't visualize them, we don't believe in them, so we don't care for them. And for example, if we believe in the narrative that the welfare state has been dismantled, that it's gone, you know, it's a lost cause, then we will stop care about it, and then it will be lost for sure. So I think perhaps what architecture or the production of a future kind of visual material could help with is to produce an awareness that allows us to care for things that might be existing or have not yet happened, and that would produce a discussion that would in turn ask what kind of economical and financial models do we need to construct to invent, you know, in order to produce this future that we want. So I think that together we can reverse this narrative, you know, of the current economic kind of system as a natural law, that's something that wasn't created by people, and start to dream of a future that could work perhaps a little bit differently. I think that would be at least my hopes.
Well, that's extremely interesting, and we are kind of going and arriving towards the end of the episode, and I would like to make a final reflection with you before we close, because even before the pandemics, the discourse about the future has been monopolized by dystopian visions. Pretty much, I mean, like Matteson writing Aniara in the middle of the Cold War was definitely a precursor, but since this, basically the beginning of the 70s, we've been seeing, the image in science fiction, especially, but also in popular culture about the future, has started to be filled with environmental catastrophes, surveillance of different kind, being it digital or being of other sort, pandemics themselves or whatever else. So we are kind of, I mean, we arrive at the COVID-19 already very far from the bright, optimistic visions of the futures that we had back in the 50s and the 60s, you know, the flying cars or whatever, you know, like colonies on the moon for going on holiday and stuff like that. So I would like to ask both of you about your vision in your respective fields of expertise, and your experience from what you've been living in the past few months. How do you see these pandemics? I see that on one hand there is a tension between two processes here, I think, at play. One is accelerator of things which were yet in motion. They were already in motion and they seem completely fast forwarded, accelerated. But on the other hand, there is also this tension with seeing the pandemics as a disruption in terms of politics, in terms of economics, as Alicia said, but also in terms of the approach towards the narratives that relates to the future. And this is also pretty much these two elements were pretty much what we heard during our trip, during the Reopening Europe traveling. This is really also among the citizens. We can really see this thing. There was this gondoliere in Venice who the first thing was saying, yeah, we want things to be back because we want tourists and so on, but now it's nice because Venice is empty and the water is clear and actually there are fishes again in the lagoon. And there's been all these kind of tensions going on. So I would like to have a final reflection on this. Disruption or acceleration?
Striking a tone of hope or positivism in relationship to this, like we need to produce like a new visual or like a new concept of the future in a sense that is like that is based on this idea that we can make it better together, then I would say, yeah, like I mean, like the best thing would of course be that this kind of pause or this break in the flow of things as usual that the pandemic has produced would provide the space for reflection and for some kind of new awareness to gain a sort of a stronger foothold. I think. I mean, if we look around the world we produced, it's not a super great place actually. So there's plenty of improvement to do, and maybe this, like, I think Alicia, what you said about speed, the speed of life, and the kind of the need to have a slower pace in the beginning of this discussion is super important. And I think that there's a hugely important point in producing sort of free time, time that is not capitalist production and time that is not recuperation or biopolitical production that needs to sustain, you know, like the capitalist production in terms of making food, giving birth, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to produce like other time. That could be civic, that could be social, that could be political and engaged, but might also be completely wasted or useless. And I think maybe this break or this space that the pandemic has produced for, I mean, the ones fortunate enough to take a break, we should also be clear that, the working poor can't take a break. They have to work still. That's why they're hit, you know, the hardest by also the pandemic. I think this break might be something that we could invest in for more utopian purposes, perhaps.
Alicia, your final reflection.
Fascinating, Rutger. Very interesting. I would only add something very concrete and simple. The gondoliere, that you were referring to. Think about having the same, his objective, of course, is to make a living. I mean, but his wish is to keep his beautiful town or city beautiful. I mean, you know, it's like, how do you do both? So very simply, imagine a world where you travel because there is a real need. I mean, not a need, because there's a real reason. Maybe you don't need to rush and stay a day in Venice, but you actually go, you know, as in the good old times, and spend 6 months and you write a beautiful novel, or you come up with a wonderful, I don't know, biotech project thanks to the different waters of Venice. I mean, I'm just saying that we were doing things as really, as we say in economists, her behavior. I mean, for no reason. I think the gondolier can be happy if people do things for a reason, for a good reason, and still make a living. So it's not so much about either or. That was what I was trying to say. Disruption or fast forwarding. It could be still, I mean, understanding that we are all, we're social beings, we're political beings, but we're also economic beings. Yeah, we need to still think about how to make a living, survive, I mean, etc. We may not need to consume so much, but we still need to consume something because we need to survive, etc. But if we make those things more, you know, with more brain, to make it very simple, I think the whole thing becomes more sustainable. It's not about changing radically, but frankly, we were on a path of stupidity. Let's face it. I mean, people were going to, you know, to places just to see something you can see on the internet, not even having any experience. So I just think this COVID-19, we should also think of it as a wake-up call, as a wake-up call of how stupid we can be. I mean, the economic rationale of many things we were doing was nil. So we don't need to kill it all, but we just need to reshape it. And so I'm just saying, I just think this is very important what you did with your, you know, with, because people are wiser than we think. If they say that, they mean it. Yeah. They mean that not everything was bad. And in fact, it wasn't. So let's get these positive things we reflected on. Because we were obliged to pause, as Rutger was saying. Maybe only when we're obliged to pause, we think, maybe, you know. And that in itself is quite important. So I just think we should all be making a list of what we learned. Keep it there. Post it on the wall. Read it every day. Let's not forget, even if we open up, yeah, even if we are into opening up Europe, maybe not, maybe we get more time to reflect very soon, I'm afraid.
Indeed.
But I mean, that's all. I think we don't need to kill everything we were doing, but we need to reflect on what we were doing that was too stupid to continue to do it, because it wasn't making any difference to us. That's the reality. Even economically, to some extent, we could still get the same objective without that back and forth, efficiency, back and forth. With that part, I think we can just let it go, frankly speaking. It will be good for everybody, including the environment.
Thank you. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you, Rutger, for joining this conversation. It was really a good way for rounding up this special feature of the Reopening Europe Summer, feature of The Sound of Economics. And I would like to remind all our listeners that they can find all the 5 episodes of the series, as well as the videos, the information about the project, on the website www.reopeningeurope.com. And on the 2nd of September, during Bruegel annual meetings, we will launch a documentary from the road trip of Reopening Europe, and you can keep up to date with the launch and the program of the annual meetings on the website www.bam.bruegel.org. Thank you for tuning in to The Sounds of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.